All right, last week we talked a little bit about the introduction to Romans, the background to Romans. There's three things that I really wanted to stress. One is the fact that a lot of times you talk to people and they think the default way God deals with humanity is in a law system. That's the way he designed Israel, that's the way we got to operate today. And if you say you are not under law and that we're not in a law system, sometimes they just look at you and like they don't even know what you're talking about because they can't fathom that. So what I tried to do last week was to show you that Israel under Moses, under the law, was a large part of the Old Testament, but there was also a time when Israel was under Moses and not under the law. And a time when God wanted to deal with Israel on the basis of grace and faith, his Jehovah name, his I Am name. I will be whatever you need me to be. Just rely on that. Remember the rod of God of faith? Just rely on me. Rely on my name. If you need anything, come to me and ask, and I will do it for you. And so there was a time when Israel was under Moses, but not under law. They hadn't received the law yet. It was from Exodus to Sinai. They didn't receive the law till Sinai. And God tells them he delivered them from the Egyptians and he carried them along as on eagle's wings and he brought them to himself. And who did all the work there? Jehovah Lord did all the work there, everything they needed. What was their part? They didn't even have a part. They just kept moving that way because they grumbled and complained and rebelled. And their flesh, their sinful flesh, always wanted to leave God's plan and purpose and go back to Israel. But in spite of that, in the grace faith system, God kept shepherding them along and made them into the people that he designed them to be. And we see that with Jethro at the end there, where Jethro comes and joins and sees what God did with Israel and delivering them from the hand of the Egyptians. And they all come together and worship God together with Israel before God. And that's a small picture of what it's going to look like when Israel one day in the future confesses their sins, national sins, and then pleads with God to receive them graciously. And that's all going to come up again. Now, why do I bring this up with Paul? Maybe some of you are saying, well, okay, that's fine, but what's this got to do with Romans? The major point I'm trying to make with that is Paul's going to come along and he's going to start saying things like a righteousness of God that is apart from law. And you're going to have a lot of people who say they don't even understand a righteousness apart from law. That's what their denomination teaches. That was what their religion teaches, whatever. And then Paul's going to come along and say, you're not under law. You're under grace. And he's going to begin driving home this point that there's something distinct and something different about the way God wants to deal with us today in a law system. And so today, I'm going to take that a step further. Basically, what I've tried to do here is, this is a timeline for Israel. And we started way back here, right here with under Moses, but before the law. That was last week. And instead of falling on God's Jehovah name, on God's Jehovah grace, the Israelites said, no, I want to do it. We will do all that's required to make us into your people. We will do it. And they contracted with God to treat them on the basis of a law system. To say these are two different programs doesn't mean there's no grace in a law system or there's no commands in a grace system. We know Paul tells us all the times to commands us to do things. Put off the old man, put on the new. Flee immorality. There's all kinds of things we're supposed to do. What differentiates this is in a system, in a law system, God is responding based on what you do, which is not true of a grace faith system. In a grace faith system, he responds based on what he does. In a law system, he responds on the basis of what the people do. And so in a law system, you have blessing for obedience, and you have cursing for disobedience. And of course, if you give a law to a sinful person, what are you going to end up with? Cursing, right. They're going to disobey, and it's going to result in the curses. I wanted to go through now the large part of Israel's history, the next roughly 1,500 years, and just review these courses of punishment. Now, I'm just doing it because I want you to see that when we get to Peter and the 12 in early Acts and Paul, there's going to be something at the end of these courses of punishment that are going to show and demonstrate that Paul cannot be continuing Israel's program. Paul cannot be continuing what Peter and 12 are doing. We're going to see that Paul's message is completely new and unique. And I'm just going to, like I did last week with the Exodus, I'm just going to kind of flit over the surface. I would highly recommend getting more information on this, the courses of punishment. John did a series on it a couple of years ago. And if this piques your interest, I would highly recommend going for more of the details and more in-depth analysis of that. But I'm just going to touch over the surfaces and show you what happened to Israel in their law system. And there, when they contracted with God to respond to them on the basis of what they do rather than on the basis of what he does. And so we're going to go and just take a look at that. We're going to look at Leviticus 26. Everyone should be able to look at Leviticus 26 and basically have an outline conception of the history of Israel. When I was taught the Leviticus 26 truth, it really opened my eyes to a lot. Suddenly, things that I could never read before, like how many here have tried reading very far into Isaiah or Jeremiah? What do you say after about chapter 2? You're like, I don't even know what's going on. I don't know what they're talking about. But if you have a basic understanding of these courses of punishment, it's going to open up the Bible for you. And if the most important thing for us is understanding distinction in Paul's unique ministry with the church, the body of Christ, versus Peter and the 12 with Israel, then I would say the second most important thing for us to know is this Leviticus 26 outline. And you don't need to be a Near Eastern scholar to understand it. You don't need to be familiar with ancient history. You just need to have a couple signposts that all of us learned in Sunday school. So I know all of us are going to be familiar with the signposts. And you can follow the whole course of Israel's history until we get to that fifth course of punishment where a very interesting thing is going to happen. And that's where we're going to start. So let's go back to Leviticus 26. We left them last week at the foot of Sinai. They say, no, we don't want to be carried along by you. We want to do it ourselves. They enter into this law-based system, and where God in his Jehovah name had brought them to him, what does he say now? He says, everyone away from the mountain. And anyone that lays a foot at even the base of the mountain, they're going to be killed. And so now there's this whole change. They've contracted with him to treat him on the basis of their own performance, merit, and effort. And now they're in a system where there's blessings for obedience and curses or chastisements for disobedience. And it might be good to just take a minute to talk about the word punishments or these chastisements or curses. These aren't God just with like a bully club waiting to hit some poor sinner because he's mad at them or something. My old Scofield Bible calls them chastisements. So that's probably a better word because the goal here is not just to punish them, it's to bring them back to him. They're going off on the wrong direction, and he wants to change their course and bring them back to him. And so there's chastisements that he's going to employ are not to be because he's mean or anything like that. It was because he's trying to get Israel to come to their senses and return to him. Let's look at Leviticus 26, and let's just start at verse 1. Leviticus 26, verse 1. Ye shall make no idols nor graven image, neither rear up a standing image, neither shall ye set up any image of stone in your land to bow down before it, for I am the Lord your God. Ye shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. So there we have two things right off the bat, and I think it probably there's two here because it summarizes everything. Idolatry includes so much, and then keeping the Sabbaths. And as we get further down in these courses of punishment, especially the fifth, we'll see one of the main reasons those come on the scene is because of idolatry and that they didn't keep the Sabbaths. Leviticus is way back at Mount Sinai, and these courses of punishment have been going on for 1,500 years. So this is prophetic. This is telling them what they're going to do. and they're going to break both of these. They're going to have major idolatry issues, and they're not going to keep their Sabbaths. All right, so now, in a law-based system, you get blessings for obedience, curses for disobedience. And most of that, except for a couple little glimmers, are going to be curses. But first, I think it'd probably be a good idea just to read through the blessings, just to see what they look like. Because if we see what the blessings look like, you'll understand all the curses. So I'm going to do this fairly quickly, and then we'll just summarize at the end. And now he says, if ye walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit, and your threshing shall reach unto the vintage, and the vintage shall reach unto the sowing time, and ye shall eat your bread to the full, and dwell in your land safely. And I will give peace in the land, and ye shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid, and I will rid evil beasts out of the land, neither shall the sword go through your land, and you shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before you by the sword. And five of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight, and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. Skip down to verse 11. And I will set my tabernacle among you, and my soul shall not abhor you, and I will walk among you, and you will be my people, and I will be your God, and ye shall be my people. I am the Lord your God, which brought you forth out of the land of Egypt, that ye should not be their bondmen, and I have broken the bonds of your yoke and made you go upright. So it's important to see here that these blessings, what is God turning this group of people into? He's turning them into a nation. So the blessings we see here are blessings are for that a nation would need to prosper. So we're seeing things like, first of all, you need a people. He's brought the people out of Egypt. He needs a place to go. They're heading to the promised land, a land flowing with milk and honey, a land prosperous. What do you need for a nation? You need some place that has good soil. You need a place that has good climate conditions. You need good and prosperous and fruitful field. You also need protection from your enemies. You need secure borders. And what the idea is here is he's going to bring them into this land. He's going to destroy their enemies. They're going to expand as far as the borders go. And they're going to dwell safely with plenty of food because there's going to be plenty of rain and the ground is going to be plentiful. They're going to have to throw away the old stuff before the new stuff comes in. And not too different from we're fortunate enough to have in this country. We almost have to clean out the cabinets of the old food before we can bring in the new food. And that nation will be prosperous then. It'll be healthy, prosperous, well-fed. The population will grow. It will fill the country with cultivation, highways and byways so they can move around the country, and it will be a functional nation. So now when you think of the curses, all you need to really do when you question why he's doing some of these curses is think of these blessings, and you'll see in most instances the exact opposite. So let's look at a couple of these. Let's look at verse 14. Here we have it set up. Verse 14, but if ye will not hearken unto me and will not do all these commandments, and if ye shall despise my statutes, or if your soul abhor my judgments, so that ye will not do all my commandments, but that ye break my covenant, which we know is basically the history of Israel from Sinai on, this is what he's going to do, verse 16. And here we have the first chastisement, the first course of punishment. Now let's just read through, and then we'll look at some of the details. And I want you to listen, and each of these, just think, but when there's just a couple verses, just think when you hear some of the descriptions in here, think of what stories you remember that fit into these descriptions. And some of these are going to be more obvious than others, but just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. Verse 16, I also will do this unto you. I will even appoint unto you terror, consumption, and burning fever that shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart, and ye shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. Now just keep that one in the back of your mind. Verse 17, and I will set my face against you, and ye shall be slain before your enemies. They that hate you will reign over you, and ye shall flee when none pursues. So now we have a couple of things. The first thing we have to notice is what God's doing here is setting his face against them. And all you parents know exactly what he's talking about. This is when your kid's not doing what he's supposed to do. You know, sometimes you don't even have to say anything. You just give them the face. That face. They stop. Well, hopefully they stop. And then they get to whatever they're supposed to be doing. And that face sets it all. The first three courses of punishment, God is setting his face against them. I'm angry. You're doing the wrong thing. Stop doing that and start doing the right thing. And then the key descriptive here is that we're going to start seeing in this first course of punishment hunger issues. Why is there going to be hunger issues? Look at the end of verse 16. You shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. They're going to start having some border raids. They're going to have people coming into the country, stealing their food, and then going back to their country with it. They're going to have some disease issues. Remember what God said when he gave him the law, that little test for the law with the manna? He said, if you keep my commandments, I won't put all the diseases of Egypt on you. Of course, the corollary of that would be, if you don't keep my commandments, I will put the diseases of Egypt on you. And of course, he didn't put them on them because at that time they weren't in a law system. He put it on the manna. But as we come in here now the disease factor is coming in. And what's one of the main reasons that they have diseases? Because the people around them have diseases. And they're having food shortages because of their borders are starting to collapse. Remember, when we get to this point, Joshua's come in the land. He's expanded pretty good. And what were they supposed to do? They were supposed to take the rest of the land, destroy the enemies. Did they do that? No. They didn't do it. So there's the enemies in the land. And this course of punishment goes with the first course of punishment. As you see, the books of the Bible goes from Judges, Ruth, and 1 Samuel. Now just think of this. He's talking about the food issues because they're having border raids, enemies coming in stealing their food. Can you think of any Sunday school stories that fit that? One would be, remember in Judges with Gideon? When God went to commission Gideon, where was he? Does anyone remember? He was in the wine press, but he wasn't pressing grapes. He was hiding down there because the enemies would have stolen his grain, and he took his grain down there to hide it and to thresh it or whatever you do with grain, and he was hiding it because of the border raids, and he was scared. What's another story from the Judges period? Ruth. Why did Ruth leave Israel? Because of food shortage. So in this first course of punishment, you start to see the nation starts to get some cracks in its framework. It's like it's not shrinking yet, but they're starting to get some cracks. They're having enemy border. Their borders are less secure. They're starting to have some hunger and disease in the land because of their rebellion against God. And that's the first course of punishment. Now let's pick it up in verse 18. And if you will not yet for all this hearken unto me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins. And that's the transition sentence where you know a new course of punishment is coming. This one's going to be the second course of punishment. And we know there's a change because of this word here. And if you will not yet for all this hearken unto me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins. He says in verse 19, he's going to now, with these courses of punishment, the important thing to remember is that they don't end. They go into the next one. So everything that was true of the first course of punishment is brought into the second course of punishment, only it's intensified. That's that sevenfold concept. And more things are added to it. So we're going to still have the hunger issue. We're still going to have the insecurity from enemies. They're coming in, stealing the grain, causing hunger in the land. And now he's going to give two other characteristics of what's going to happen in the second course of punishment. Verse 19. And I will break the pride of your power, and I will make your heaven as iron, and your earth as brass. And your strength shall be spent in vain, for your land shall not yield her increase, neither shall the trees of the land yield their fruits. Now the pride of their power was that they would be a unified nation under God. All 12 tribes of the nation of Israel together as a single nation under God. And when we get to the second course of punishment, what's going to happen during this time, as shown in 1 Samuel 16 to 1 Kings 12, is that the nation is going to divide. Remember, the 10 tribes are going to go up to Samaria. They're going to be called the Northern Kingdom of Israel. And then you have the Southern Kingdom with the two tribes that go to Jerusalem, and they become the Southern tribe. During this historical time, you have a breakup of the country. And that's that whole idea where God brings them in to fill the land, secure their borders, and what you're going to see through this whole series of courses of punishment is that whole thing begins to crack, and then it begins to collapse. And by the time we get to the fifth course of punishment, there's going to be one little spot on the map called Jerusalem. And then that's going to vanish. And so that's the progression you're seeing here. You're seeing the dissolution, really, of the nation as they move along here. So now, at the second course of punishment, we have a division of the kingdom. And you remember what Jesus said, if a kingdom's divided, how shall they fight? How shall they conquer? And that's what's going to happen now. They're two separate nations, basically, two different kingdoms in this nation Israel. And the second thing is, look at verse 19. And I will make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass. That's indicative of a drought setting in. And, you know, when I first started learning this, I found it really hard to go by the books of the Bible because I can never remember them. So I put that in my Bible as a reference. But the way I really remember the courses of punishment is the prophets that they're associated with. And the prophet Elijah is associated with the second course of punishment. And what was the main thing Elijah did? Does anyone remember? He brought on 3 years of drought. That was the course of the punishment. He's going to now introduce God in the courses of punishment. He's going to introduce climate changes in the land. And that's what it means here when he says, the sky, it's not going to rain. It's going to be drought for years. Your heaven may as well be made out of brass and your earth may as well be iron. Because without rain, nothing's going to be fruitful and multiply. You're going to have now not be able to grow crops. You're not going to be able to cultivate the ground. The hunger issue that comes all the way from the first course of punishment now is going to be intensified further, and all because of their rebellion and idolatry against God. And so that's the third course of punishment associated with Elijah. So you see it just getting worse and worse. Here we had the full nation, a large part of the nation of Joshua. The Israelites rebel. They refuse to remove the enemies. They then diminish. They have personal and national issues. And then that results in the divided kingdom. And now we have a climate problems. And the whole nation is just getting shrinking smaller and smaller. Now let's read about the third course of punishment. Verse 21. And if you walk contrary unto me and will not hearken unto me, which of course they did walk contrary to him, I will bring seven times more plagues upon you according to your sins. So here we know that there's a new course of punishment starting. That's that phrase. If you walk contrary to me and will not hearken to me, I will bring seven times more plagues unto you. So he's going to bring everything in from the first two courses of punishment, intensify them, and now he's going to add something else. And I'm sure everyone here will be able to tell me what this refers to in history. So let's read verse 21. And I will also send wild beasts among you, which shall rob you of your children and destroy your cattle and make you few in numbers, and your highway shall be desolate. Who was the prophet that had that really odd story about walking down the road and the children, which were not toddlers, they were young people at probably at a false prophet school, and they came out to ridicule and to scoff at Elisha, and what happened? The wild beast came and ate the children. And Leviticus was written years before that. I mean, hundreds of years before that. So here we have the third course of punishment. He wrote this hundreds of years before. That's a key, that's the third course of punishment clicking into place. And the other thing to note here is that, you know, these wild beasts, it wasn't like they just came out of nowhere. The issue is the collapse of the nation, because it was supposed to be cultivated and expanded to the borders, and they were supposed to be out in the fields, working the fields, cultivating the land, but because of the hunger and the drought they started shrinking back to the cities. And so what do you think happened to the land that used to be cultivated? It turns back into wilderness. And what comes with a wilderness? Wild animals. And this wilderness starts coming in and in and in. The people are going more and more to the cities. Their highways are desolate because they're having more enemy attacks. If they don't get eaten by a wild animal, they're getting killed in enemy attacks. And so, again, it's this idea the nation is collapsing in on itself. It's just getting smaller and smaller. Now they're not out in the country anymore. The drought, no sense going out to farm because the drought is going to cause the ground not to produce anything. And they start heading to the cities. And their highways are desolate. There's no one moving around. Enemy attacks and wild beasts and the wilderness encroaching in. Now let's look at the fourth chastisement, verse 23. And there's a big change here. Let's look at this one. And if ye will not be reformed by me by these things, but will walk contrary unto me, which is exactly what they did, then will I also walk contrary unto you. In physics, they call this a quantum leap. Remember before, for the first three, he had set his face against them. Now he was going to get up and walk contrary to them. And this is a big advance in the program. This is a big advance in the courses of punishment. Verse 23, if you walk contrary to me, verse 24, then will I also walk contrary unto you and will punish you yet seven times for your sins. So that's the announcement. There's a new course of punishment. It's a quantum leap because he's not only going to have his face set against them, but he's also going to be walking contrary to them. Verse 25, and I will bring a sword upon you that shall avenge the quarrel of my covenant. And when you are gathered together in your cities, remember what I was just saying? The wilderness coming in, the enemies are coming through the borders, and they're hunger, they're sick, they're going to the cities. They're collecting in the cities. And when you are gathered together within your cities, I will send the pestilence among you, and you shall be delivered into the hand of the enemy. And when I have broken the staff of your bread, 10 women shall bake your bread in one oven, and they shall deliver you your bread again by weight, and you shall eat and not be satisfied. So we have a concentration that started way back in one, that hunger, the enemy attacks, the wilderness encroachment, it's all pushing them into their cities. Now just what do you think is going to happen when you got a lot of malnutritioned people with illnesses all gathering in small locations? It's probably not going to result in anything good. And that's the fourth course of punishment, where everything is just collapsing. They're going into their cities, and they're staying there. They're looking for refuge there. There's hunger. They have enemy attacks. It's just consolidating down. So now we've gone from a whole land, a whole national land, to a few cities, and I'll see what happens in the fifth chastisement. And this is really the one we want to focus on when it comes to Peter and the 12 and Paul, because something is going to change in this fifth course of punishment that we have to take note of. So the fifth chastisement, verse 27. And if you will not for all this hearken unto me, but walk contrary unto me, then I will walk contrary unto you also in fury. So here we have another quantum leap. We've gone from setting his face against them to walking contrary to them, and now he's going to walk contrary to them in fury, because of their disobedience and lack of response to his chastisements. Verse 28, then I will walk contrary unto you in fury, and I, even I, will chastise you seven times for your sins. And ye shall eat the flesh of your sons, and the flesh of your daughters shall ye eat, and I will destroy your high places, and cut down your images, and cast your carcasses upon the carcasses of your idols, and my soul shall abhor you, and I will make your cities waste and bring your sanctuaries unto desolation, and I will not smell the savor of your sweet odors, and I will bring the land into desolation, and your enemies that dwell therein shall be astonished at it, and I will scatter you among the heathen and will draw the sword after you, and your land shall be desolate and your cities waste. Then shall your land enjoy her Sabbaths. And so now we have God walking in fury against them. You have the consolidation to the cities. And I'm not going to give the references here. I have the reference if anyone wants them. But everything listed here, destroy your high places, cut down your images, your idols, cutting down of the sanctuaries, that's all documented in those books in 2 Kings and on. You have the exact description historically of these things happening in the history of Israel. But the one we really want to focus on is the scattering concept. So they've had this whole nation. They've had border raids that makes Gideon hide in the wine press, so because he's afraid they're going to steal his grain, and Ruth to flee the nation. The nation is cracking. It starts to come in on itself with hunger and drought. They can't work the land. They come in towards the cities. The wilderness comes in. The wild beasts come in. And there's no one walking on the highways and byways anymore. And because it's either the wild beasts are going to get them or the enemies are going to get them. They come in the cities. They're malnutrition, sick, and they end up being totally desolate in the cities. And then in this fourth course of punishment, Assyria is going to come in and take away the northern kingdom of Israel and scatter them among the nations, just like it says in verse 32. It's kind of a foretaste of what would happen to Judah. And the only thing left, when you get to the end of the fourth course of punishment, where just before we're at now, the only thing left of national Israel is Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is surrounded by the armies of Assyria. It's described in Isaiah as an eagle flying over the land, and I almost get the impression it's more like a dragon flying over the land, and it just engulfs up everything and encircles the land, overcomes everything in the land, and the only thing left is Jerusalem. And here in the fifth course of punishment, as the fifth course begins, Jerusalem itself is going to fall. Babylon is going to come and take them away captive and take them back to Babylon. And that's where we'll be at the beginning of the fifth course of punishment. And to think that Leviticus 26 foresaw all that, even to the points of giving you details that will click your thinking as they happen in history hundreds of years later, and all this was foreseen, and all this was because Israel had chose to be in a law contract system with God instead of a grace faith system. And now we're at the fifth course of punishment, which is really where we want to take note of one specific thing. All the other courses of punishment, Israelites could have changed the progress. Remember, he says at each of these editions that if you continue, they had the opportunity to change their ways and to be directed by God, but they refused. We hit the fifth course of punishment, and there's no turning back. And there's no turning back because with the fifth course of punishment, God is now going to set in stone a time schedule. He gets a clock, and he turns it on, and now he's going to give us an exact time schedule for everything that's going to happen to the completion of Israel. And he's going to start listing that time schedule out so that everybody knows exactly when something's going to happen, when it's going to be over, when the next thing's going to start, and when to watch for things. If we look at this chart, the whole time frame is 560 years, beginning with the Babylon captivity. When Judah goes into the Babylon captivity, Jeremiah is going to tell us that's going to be 70 years long. So for this very first one, we know from Jeremiah, that's going to be 70 years long. So Daniel, he was in Babylon. He's already been taken captive. This is a further point down the line. And he's in there reading Jeremiah. And he reads this verse from Jeremiah, who wrote years before that, and said 70 years in Babylon. So Daniel says the 70 years are almost up. And God gives him the rest of the time schedule. So from the 70 years that Jeremiah gave at the Babylonian captivity, and then God gives Daniel 490 years to the completion of Israel's program. He was going to complete Israel's program in 490 years, and he was going to make them into the people that he desired them to be in 490 years. And then Daniel gives the breakdown. There's going to be 49 years under Persian rule, and that begins with, you know, the Cyrus and the rebuilding of the wall. Cyrus was the Persian king, and that would be 49 years. Then Daniel says that there would be 434 years until the arrival of Christ and, most importantly, the cutting off of Christ, the death of Christ. And that would be 434 years. We know that that 34-year period occurred here. That's already happened. And in between that 49 and 34 years is 400 years of silence. Amos is going to talk about that. And so there's this 70-year period, 49-year period, 400-year period that when Christ arrives and is cutting off, and then there's one 7-year period after that, which is what we call tribulation period, day of the wrath of the Lord. And then he returns as king and sets up the kingdom with Israel as the head of the nation instead of the tail. That's the time frame. That is something that everyone in first century Israel should have known if they didn't know. And we know there are people who did know it. Remember Simeon and Anna? Why were they waiting in the temple? Because they knew it was about the time for the arrival of the Messiah. Why did the wise men come from the east at that time? East is probably Babylon there. Daniel was in Babylon writing these time prophecies. And they came and they showed up at the exact time the Messiah was supposed to arrive. And so this time schedule was known and should have been used. The 400 years of silence, during that time, they should have been reading the prophets to see this time schedule. Another reason why we know that they knew the time schedule is Matthew. Remember when Matthew is breaking up his genealogy and he makes a big point of when the captivity went into Babylon. Now, why does he bring that up out of the blue like that? Because it's at that exact point that a sincere Jew would be able to jump on the timeline and know that at that point after the captivity would be 490 years and the time was then. And so this time frame sets everything in perspective. They should have known this. Matthew knew it. He sets his time. It's a proof that Christ was really the Christ and that he had arrived on exactly on schedule. That's one of the proofs Matthew uses, is that it's the exact time from the point they went to the Babylon captivity to the point that Christ arrived on the scene. And then, of course, is cutting off from there. So now, this is going to kind of lead into next week now, because why is this so important? Because right here, this 34-year period includes the ministry of Christ and Peter and the 12. And when we get into Acts, and we get into what Peter's preaching at Pentecost, he knows exactly what he's talking about. He's going to be preaching about the arrival of this 7-year period. He's going to plead with the leaders who've rejected Christ to receive Christ, because the next thing on the time schedule was for Christ to return in his anger and wrath against his enemies. We'll see that next week when chapters 2 and 3 is just straight setting forth that he knew his timeline and that was the next thing on his timeline. And that's what he preached. And that's where Paul comes in. Because all of a sudden, the Israel we know didn't believe, didn't return to Christ, didn't accept him. And what does Paul arrive on the scene saying? He's saying God is now holding back his wrath a little while longer. He's going to bring everyone under the title of sinner, Jew and Gentile, so that he can save his enemies. And now we know something new is happening in God's plan and purpose. Because Peter would say he was coming to deliver his friends and avenge his enemies. And the wrath was the next thing to happen. And Paul comes on the scene and he says, God is holding back his wrath a little while longer so that he could offer grace and peace to his enemies. And it's a whole different thing. And he's going to then explain later in Romans what happened with this. He's going to explain, was God unjust? Was God unrighteous? Is God unfaithful? Did God just decide not to finish his timeline? And of course, Paul's going to explain God is righteous, God is faithful, and he's just put this time schedule on pause, like your video recorder. You just hit the pause button, and it's set there. One day, when the church is raptured out, he's going to hit that button again, and it's going to pick up right where Peter and the 12 left off and finish that last 7 years. But now, Paul has come on the scene at the exact point when it was most helpless for the world. Gentiles didn't even have a hope, and Israel had rejected their hope, and there was really no hope for anyone. And God comes on the scene now, and he says, right at the point of lowest hope, right when God should have returned in his wrath and anger, he instead returned, raised up Paul, and gave Paul a message that he's going to hold back his wrath a little longer so that he can offer peace and grace to a world of his enemies. And that's what we're living in today. That's when you see your neighbors out doing their lawn, when you work with your coworkers, that's what they need today. That's what they need to hear, that God is holding back his wrath a little longer. That's why I'm bringing this up now. If you don't know this timeline, you don't understand anything about the courses of punishment or how this works, you're going to think Paul's just continuing what Peter and the 12 were doing, or you're going to think he's doing extension of Christ's ministry in the Gospels, or you're going to have a thousand other things. But this timeline precludes that because everything was set on a time frame, and many people recognized it at the time. And now Paul has been sent to interrupt that and to announce that God has put that on pause. He hasn't done away with it. It's not that he's not going to fulfill it, but he's paused it so that at the lowest point of humanity, he's going to step in and offer grace and peace to his enemies. And I don't know about you, but that's about the most joyful thing I can think of. I'll pick that up next week, and we're going to get more into Romans next week directly. But I thought for this week we'd finish with the courses of punishment and make it maybe a little more practical. Because if you take some time to learn this, and like I said earlier, you don't need to be a history scholar. You don't have to have 4 PhDs on Assyrian history or anything like that. This is all really simple if we just learn some of the basics. And it's really practical for understanding the Old Testament, and in the Old Testament especially, the prophets, because they are going to set up their books of the Bible, like Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel. They're going to be organized according to these time frames in the fifth course of punishment. So I thought we'd just look at Isaiah and just maybe show you how practical this is. Who knows? This might be so practical for you when you're done that maybe tonight, instead of watching late night TV or reruns of Dancing with the Stars, you'll open up Isaiah and read some of it. All right, Isaiah 1. This isn't just a history lesson. These are little pegs, especially when you get to the fifth course of punishment with these time frames. And you can call them installments. I think a lot of people call them installments of the fifth course of punishment. So this is the fifth course of punishment, and installment 1, installment 2, installment 3, 4, and 5. But whatever you call them, it doesn't matter. Because now when you get to the prophets, the structure of their book is going to be based on that. And if you know it, sometimes when you jump in the book and you wonder, what in the world is he talking about? If you know what section he's referring to, all of a sudden you might find that things start making more sense. So the first thing to know about these installments or time periods and the prophets, and we're going to look at Isaiah, the first thing to know is, one, they start where they, I'll just say, where they live. Okay, what do I mean by that? They're going to start where they're at in the program. So like Isaiah is actually at the end of the fourth course of punishment, and he's going to prophesy looking ahead to the fifth course of punishment. So he's going to start in the fourth. Now Daniel, on the other hand, he's a captive in Babylon. He's going to start with the captivity in Babylon where he is. Remember the first half of Daniel, what's it about? It's about him and the king of Babylon. And it's showing what's going on there. And then he's going to go on and prophesy about this and this and this and this. When you open up your prophets, it's going to start, and this is general, everything, nothing works perfectly all the time, but generally they're going to start where they live. So Isaiah is going to start in the fourth course of punishment, near the end of the fourth course of punishment. And so what they're going to do is they're going to take where they're at, and they're going to talk about things that are going on then. And so he's going to start by talking about what's going on at the end of that fourth course of punishment. Remember from Leviticus, they're in their cities, they're sick, they're being attacked by enemies. The Assyrian are coming in and swooping in and are in the process of gobbling up everything except Jerusalem. So he's going to go ahead and describe what's happening in that time and why Israel is worthy of the fifth course of punishment. So let's just open up to Isaiah 1. Isaiah 1, and just see this. The vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Now Hezekiah ought to be familiar. Those are all fourth course of punishment kings. So he sets his ground. This is where he's at, the end of the fourth course of punishment. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord hath spoken. I have nourished and brought children, and they have rebelled against me. See, he's talking about what the Israelites have done and why they deserve these courses of punishment, even though he doesn't like doing it. Verse 4, and a sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corrupt. And he's going to go on and explain why the Israelites are worthy of receiving the fifth course of punishment. Look at verse 5. Why should ye be stricken anymore? You see what he's pleading here? He's saying, strickening are the courses of punishment. I struck you with the first course and the second course and the third course and the fourth course, and you didn't change your ways, you didn't change your thinking. In fact, you rebelled more against me than before. Why would I even do a fifth course of punishment? And he's going to explain why he's going to do a fifth course of punishment, because he's going to end this cycle entirely. There's no more courses after the fifth, and he's going to make Israel into the people he wants. If you remember usually the prophets start by talking about where they're at. This actually is 1 through 37. All right. Then they're going to go on from there, and they're going to talk about usually logical progression as they're going to bring. They're going to be talking about a lot of different things, but there's going to be a bulk of doctrine about the first course of punishment in the fifth. I mean, the first installment of the fifth, which would be the Babylonian captivity. So let's go ahead and write this here. So now they're going to talk about fifth course punishment, first installment, or the first time period, which is Babylon. Flip over to chapter 38 and 39. I was going to read more, but you're all familiar with this story. Hezekiah, remember, he's sick, and God says he'll lengthen his days and does the whole sundial, making the sundial go backward. And Hezekiah gets better, and emissaries from Babylon come to visit him because he was sick. And does anyone remember what Hezekiah did? What did he show them? The riches of the temple and the riches of the city. And Isaiah is like, what are you doing? Why are you showing Babylon the riches of our temple and city? And then Isaiah is going to make this very important prophecy. Chapter 39, verse 5. Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith the Lord, and thy sons that shall issue from you, which thou shalt beget, shall thee take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. And so we have the setup of the first time here, Babylon. It progressed from what was happening then, and now he's prophesying about what's going to happen in the first installment, and they're going to go into Babylonian captivity. Then, let's just kind of list these out real quick. This is chapter 38 and 39. And then the second one is going to deal with the Persian attack. And that's going to be 40 to 48. Now he's going to go on to the second time frame, the Medo-Persian. Let's look at chapter 44, verse 28. Thus saith Cyrus. Now remember, this is written 300 years before the Persian king Cyrus was on the scene. Isaiah is looking ahead 300 years, and he says, that saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. And he goes on to explain that more in the next chapter. And he's talking about this, the second, when the Persians let Judah leave Babylon, go back to Jerusalem to rebuild the wall of the city and to rebuild the temple. And that's what we got in this. Now, what I'm trying to show is if you have this basic outline, the prophets will become much more understandable. Now, let's just go on to the third one. That's the time of silence. So Amos talks some about that, but otherwise there's nothing going on the third one. There's just, it's silence. The fourth installment now deals with the earthly ministry of Christ. So let's flip a couple pages over in Isaiah and go over to chapter 53. You all know and have read a million times. Now he's progressed from the what was happening in his day to the first installment, to the second installment, to the third, and now he's on the fourth installment. Chapter 53. Who hath believed our report, and to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? Verse 2. For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of dry ground. He hath no form, no comeliness, and when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we shall desire him. Let's go with down to verse 4. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteem him as stricken, smitten of God and afflicted. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities, and the chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. We are all like sheep gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. Who is he talking about? You know now he's talking about the earthly ministry and death, the cutting off of Christ. And this covers chapters 49 to 57. The last one is going to deal with the fifth installment, the seven-year tribulation period. And I'll give you those chapters are 58 to 66. And those are going to talk about the return of the Redeemer and that he's going to avenge of his enemies and deliver his friends and come back as king, set up his kingdom, and raise Israel to be the head of the nations and the light to the Gentile nations. And through her, all the nations would come and bless and worship God. And that's where we're going to leave it. But why I put this out here is all the prophets follow this general, it's not always written in stone, but this general framework. Especially the fifth course of punishment with the five installments, you can kind of follow along and get a really good footing on each of these sections.